You want to make him, little Nicholas, into an old maid like yourself. A pity. Prince Andrew wants a son and not an old maid, he would say. Or turning to Mademoiselle Bourienne, he would ask her in Princess Mary's presence how she liked our village priests and icons, and would joke about them. He continually hurt Princess Mary's feelings and tormented her, but it cost her no effort to forgive him. Could he be to blame toward her? Or could her father, who she knew loved her in spite of it all, be unjust? And what is justice? The princess never thought of that proud word, justice. All the complex laws of man centered for her in one clear and simple law, the law of love and self-sacrifice taught us by him who lovingly suffered for mankind, though he himself was God. What had she to do with the justice or injustice of other people? She had to endure and love, and that she did. During the winter, Prince Andrew had come to Bald Hills and had been gay, gentle, and more affectionate than Princess Mary had known him for a long time past. She felt that something had happened to him, but he said nothing to her about his love. Before he left, he had a long talk with his father about something, and Princess Mary noticed that before his departure they were dissatisfied with one another. Soon after Prince Andrew had gone, Princess Mary wrote to her friend Julie Karagina in Petersburg, whom she had dreamed, as all girls dream, of marrying to her brother, and who was at that time in mourning for her own brother, killed in Turkey. "Sorrow, it seems, is our common lot, my dear, tender friend Julie. Your loss is so terrible that I can only explain it to myself as a special providence of God, who, loving you, wishes to try you and your excellent mother. Oh, my friend, religion and religion alone can, I will not say comfort us, but save us from despair. Religion alone can explain to us what, without its help, man cannot comprehend. Why, for what cause, kind and noble beings able to find happiness in life, not merely harming no one, but necessary to the happiness of others, are called away to God, while cruel, useless, harmful persons, or such as are a burden to themselves and to others, are left living. The first death I saw, and one I shall never forget, that of my dear sister-in-law, left that impression on me. Just as you asked destiny why your splendid brother had to die, so I asked why that angel Lees, who not only never wronged anyone, but in whose soul there were never any unkind thoughts, had to die. And what do you think, dear friend? 5 years have passed since then, and already I, with my petty understanding, begin to see clearly why she had to die, and in what way that death was but an expression of the infinite goodness of the Creator, whose every action, though generally incomprehensible to us, is but a manifestation of his infinite love for his creatures. Perhaps, I often think, she was too angelically innocent to have the strength to perform all of a mother's duties. As a young wife, she was irreproachable. Perhaps she could not have been so as a mother. As it is, not only has she left us, and particularly Prince Andrew, with the purest regrets and memories, but probably she will there receive a place I dare not hope for myself. But not to speak of her alone, that early and terrible death has had the most beneficent influence on me and on my brother, in spite of all our grief. Then, at the moment of our loss, these thoughts could not occur to me. I should then have dismissed them with horror, but now they are very clear and certain. I write all this to you, dear friend, only to convince you of the gospel truth which has become for me a principle of life. Not a single hair of our heads will fall without his will. And his will is governed only by infinite love for us, and so whatever befalls us is for our good. You ask whether we shall spend next winter in Moscow. In spite of my wish to see you, I do not think so, and do not want to do so. You will be surprised to hear that the reason for this is Buonaparte. The case is this. My father's health is growing noticeably worse. He cannot stand any contradiction and is becoming irritable. This irritability is, as you know, chiefly directed to political questions. He cannot endure the notion that Buonaparte is negotiating on equal terms with all the sovereigns of Europe, and particularly with our own, the grandson of the great Catherine. As you know, I am quite indifferent to politics, but from my father's remarks and his talks with Michael Ivanovich, I know all that goes on in the world, and especially about the honors conferred on Buonaparte, who only at Bald Hills in the whole world, it seems, is not accepted as a great man, still less as Emperor of France. And my father cannot stand this. It seems to me that it is chiefly because of his political views that my father is reluctant to speak of going to Moscow, for he foresees the encounters that would result from his way of expressing his views regardless of anybody. All the benefit he might derive from a course of treatment, he would lose as a result of the disputes about Buonaparte, which would be inevitable. In any case, it will be decided very shortly. Our family life goes on in the old way, except for my brother Andrew's absence. He, as I wrote you before, has changed very much of late. After his sorrow, he only this year quite recovered his spirits. He has again become as I used to know him when a child, kind, affectionate, with that heart of gold to which I know no equal. He has realized, it seems to me, that life is not over for him. But together with this mental change, he has grown physically much weaker. He has become thinner and more nervous. I am anxious about him, and glad he is taking this trip abroad which the doctors recommended long ago. I hope it will cure him. You write that in Petersburg he is spoken of as one of the most active, cultivated, and capable of the young men. Forgive my vanity as a relation, but I never doubted it. The good he has done to everybody here, from his peasants up to the gentry, is incalculable. On his arrival in Petersburg, he received only his due. I always wonder at the way rumors fly from Petersburg to Moscow, especially such false ones as that you write about. I mean the report of my brother's betrothal to the little Rostova. I do not think my brother will ever marry again, and certainly not her. And this is why. First, I know that though he rarely speaks about the wife he has lost, the grief of that loss has gone too deep in his heart for him ever to decide to give her a successor, and our little angel a stepmother. Secondly, because, as far as I know, that girl is not the kind of girl who could please Prince Andrew. I do not think he would choose her for a wife, and frankly I do not wish it. But I'm running on too long, and am at the end of my second sheet. Goodbye, my dear friend. May God keep you in his holy and mighty care. My dear friend, Mademoiselle Bourienne, sends you kisses. Mary. Chapter 17. Prince N. Bolkonski threatens to marry Mademoiselle Bourienne. In the middle of the summer, Princess Mary received an unexpected letter from Prince Andrew in Switzerland, in which he gave her strange and surprising news. He informed her of his engagement to Natasha Rostova. The whole letter breathed loving rapture for his betrothed and tender and confiding affection for his sister. He wrote that he had never loved as he did now, and that only now did he understand and know what life was. He asked his sister to forgive him for not having told her of his resolve when he had last visited Bald Hills, though he had spoken of it to his father. He had not done so, for fear Princess Mary should ask her father to give his consent, irritating him, and having to bear the brunt of his displeasure without attaining her object. "Besides," he wrote, "the matter was not then so definitely settled as it is now. My father then insisted on a delay of a year, and now already 6 months, half of that period, have passed, and my resolution is firmer than ever. If the doctors did not keep me here at the Spas, I should be back in Russia, but as it is, I have to postpone my return for 3 months. You know me and my relations with father. I want nothing from him. I have been and always shall be independent. But to go against his will and arouse his anger, now that he may perhaps remain with us such a short time, would destroy half my happiness. I am now writing to him about the same question, and beg you to choose a good moment to hand him the letter, and to let me know how he looks at the whole matter, and whether there is hope that he may consent to reduce the term by 4 months. After long hesitations, doubts, and prayers, Princess Mary gave the letter to her father. The next day the old prince said to her quietly, "Write and tell your brother to wait until I am dead. It won't be long. I shall soon set him free." The princess was about to reply, but her father would not let her speak, and raising his voice more and more, cried, "Mary, Mary, my boy, a good family, clever people, eh? Rich, eh? Yes, a nice stepmother little Nicholas will have. Write and tell him that he may marry tomorrow if he likes. She will be little Nicholas's stepmother, and I'll marry Bourienne. He mustn't be without a stepmother either. Only one thing. No more women are wanted in my house. Let him marry and live by himself. Perhaps you will go and live with him too?" he added, turning to Princess Mary. "Go, in heaven's name. Go out into the frost, the frost, the frost." After this outburst, the prince did not speak any more about the matter. But repressed vexation at his son's poor-spirited behavior found expression in his treatment of his daughter. To his former pretexts for irony, a fresh one was now added: allusions to stepmothers and amiabilities to Mademoiselle Bourienne. "Why shouldn't I marry her?" he asked his daughter. "She'll make a splendid princess." And latterly, to her surprise and bewilderment, Princess Mary noticed that her father was really associating more and more with the Frenchwoman. She wrote to Prince Andrew about the reception of his letter, but comforted him with hopes of reconciling their father to the idea. Little Nicholas and his education, her brother Andrew and religion, were Princess Mary's joys and consolations. But besides that, since everyone must have personal hopes, Princess Mary, in the profoundest depths of her heart, had a hidden dream and hope that supplied the chief consolation of her life. This comforting dream and hope were given her by God's folk, the half-witted and other pilgrims who visited her without the prince's knowledge. The longer she lived, the more experience and observation she had of life, the greater was her wonder at the short-sightedness of men who seek enjoyment and happiness here on earth, toiling, suffering, struggling, and harming one another to obtain that impossible, visionary, sinful happiness. Prince Andrew had loved his wife. She died, but that was not enough. He wanted to bind his happiness to another woman. Her father objected to this because he wanted a more distinguished and wealthier match for Andrew. And they all struggled and suffered and tormented one another and injured their souls, their eternal souls, for the attainment of benefits which endure but for an instant. Not only do we know this ourselves, but Christ, the Son of God, came down to earth and told us that this life is but for a moment and is a probation. Yet we cling to it and think to find happiness in it. How is it that no one realizes this? Thought Princess Mary. No one except these despised God's folk, who wallet on back, come to me by the back door, afraid of being seen by the prince, not for fear of ill usage by him, but for fear of causing him to sin. To leave family, home, and all the cares of worldly welfare, in order, without clinging to anything, to wander in hempen rags from place to place under an assumed name, doing no one any harm, but praying for all, for those who drive one away as well as for those who protect one. Higher than that life and truth, there is no life or truth. There was one pilgrim, a quiet, pockmarked little woman of 50 called Theodosia, who for over 30 years had gone about barefoot and worn heavy chains. Princess Mary was particularly fond of her. Once, when in a room with a lamp dimly lit before the icon, Theodosia was talking of her life, the thought that Theodosia alone had found the true path of life suddenly came to Princess Mary with such force that she resolved to become a pilgrim herself. When Theodosia had gone to sleep, Princess Mary thought about this for a long time, and at last made up her mind that, strange as it might seem, she must go on a pilgrimage. She disclosed this thought to no one but to her confessor, Father Akinfi, the monk, and he approved of her intention. Under guise of a present for the pilgrims, Princess Mary prepared a pilgrim's complete costume for herself, a coarse smock vast shoes, a rough coat, and a black kerchief. Often, approaching the chest of drawers containing this secret treasure, Princess Mary paused, uncertain whether the time had not already come to put her project into execution. Often, listening to the pilgrims' tales, she was so stimulated by their simple speech, mechanical to them, but to her so full of deep meaning, that several times she was on the point of abandoning everything and running away from home. In imagination, she already pictured herself by Theodosia's side, dressed in coarse rags, walking with a staff, a wallet on her back, along the dusty road, directing her wanderings from one saint's shrine to another, free from envy, earthly love, or desire, and reaching at last the place where there is no more sorrow or sighing, but eternal joy and bliss. "I shall come to a place and pray there, and before having time to get used to it or to getting to love it, I shall go farther. I will go on till my legs fail, and I'll lie down and die somewhere, and shall at last reach that eternal quiet haven where there is neither sorrow nor sighing," thought Princess Mary. But afterwards, when she saw her father, and especially little Coco, Nicholas, her resolve weakened. She wept quietly and felt that she was a sinner who loved her father and little nephew more than God. Book 7, 1810 to 11, Chapter 1. Nicholas Rostov returns home on leave, his doubts about Natasha's engagement. The Bible legend tells us that the absence of labor, idleness, was a condition of the first man's blessedness before the fall. Fallen man has retained a love of idleness, but the curse weighs on the race not only because we have to seek our bread in the sweat of our brows, but because our moral nature is such that we cannot be both idle and at ease. An inner voice tells us we are in the wrong if we are idle. If man could find a state in which he felt that, though idle, he was fulfilling his duty, he would have found one of the conditions of man's primitive blessedness. And such a state of obligatory and irreproachable idleness is the lot of a whole class, the military. The chief attraction of military service has consisted and will consist in this compulsory and irreproachable idleness. Nicholas Rostov experienced this blissful condition to the full when, after 1807, he continued to serve in the Pavlograd regiment, in which he already commanded the squadron he had taken over from Denisov. Rostov had become a bluff, good-natured fellow, whom his Moscow acquaintances would have considered rather bad form, but who was liked and respected by his comrades, subordinates, and superiors, and was well contented with his life. Of late, in 1809, he found in letters from home more frequent complaints from his mother that their affairs were falling into greater and greater disorder, and that it was time for him to come back to gladden and comfort his old parents. Reading these letters, Nicholas felt a dread of their wanting to take him away from surroundings in which, protected from all the entanglements of life, he was living so calmly and quietly. He felt that sooner or later he would have to re-enter that whirlpool of life, with its embarrassments and affairs to be straightened out, its accounts with stewards, quarrels and intrigues, its ties, society, and with Sonya's love and his promise to her. It was all dreadfully difficult and complicated, and he replied to his mother in cold formal letters in French, beginning, "My dear Mama," and ending, "Your obedient son," which said nothing of when he would return. In 1810 he received letters from his parents in which they told him of Natasha's engagement to Bolkonski, and that the wedding would be in a year's time because the old prince made difficulties. This letter grieved and mortified Nicholas. In the first place, he was sorry that Natasha, for whom he cared more than for anyone else in the family, should be lost to the home. And secondly, from his hussar point of view, he regretted not to have been there to show that fellow Bolkonski that connection with him was no such great honor after all, and that if he loved Natasha, he might dispense with permission from his dotard father. For a moment, he hesitated whether he should not apply for leave in order to see Natasha before she was married. But then came the maneuvers, and considerations about Sonya, and about the confusion of their affairs, and Nicholas again put it off. But in the spring of that year, he received a letter from his mother, written without his father's knowledge, and that letter persuaded him to return. She wrote that if he did not come and take matters in hand, their whole property would be sold by auction, and they would all have to go begging. The Count was so weak, and trusted Mityanka so much, and was so good-natured, that everybody took advantage of him, and things were going from bad to worse. For God's sake, I implore you, come at once if you do not wish to make me and the whole family wretched, wrote the Countess. This letter touched Nicholas. He had that common sense of a matter-of-fact man which showed him what he ought to do. The right thing now was, if not to retire from the service, at any rate to go home on leave. Why he had to go, he did not know. But after his after-dinner nap, he gave orders to saddle Mars, an extremely vicious gray stallion that had not been ridden for a long time, and when he returned with the horse all in a lather, he informed Lavrushka, Denisov's servant who had remained with him, and his comrades who turned up in the evening, that he was applying for leave and was going home. Difficult and strange as it was for him to reflect that he would go away without having heard from the staff, and this interested him extremely, whether he was promoted to a captaincy or would receive the Order of St. Anne for the last manoeuvres, strange as it was to think that he would go away without having sold his 3 roans to the Polish Count Goluchowski, who was bargaining for the horses Rostov had betted he would sell for 2,000 rubles, incomprehensible as it seemed that the ball the hussars were giving in honor of the Polish Mademoiselle Pszczecka, out of rivalry to the Uhlans, who had given one in honor of their Polish Mademoiselle Borzozowska, would take place without him. He knew he must go away from this good, bright world to somewhere where everything was stupid and confused. A week later, he obtained his leave. His hussar comrades, not only those of his own regiment, but the whole brigade, gave Rostov a dinner to which the subscription was 15 rubles a head, and at which there were 2 bands and 2 choirs of singers. Rostov danced the trepak with Major Basov. The tipsy officers tossed, embraced, and dropped Rostov. The soldiers of the 3rd squadron tossed him too and shouted hurrah, and then they put him in his sleigh and escorted him as far as the 1st post station. During the first half of the journey, from Kremenchuk to Kiev, all Rostov's thoughts, as is usual in such cases, were behind him with the squadron. But when he had gone more than halfway, he began to forget his 3 roans and Dozhoyevko, his quartermaster, and to wonder anxiously how things would be at Otradnoye and what he would find there. Thoughts of home grew stronger the nearer he approached it, far stronger, as though this feeling of his was subject to the law by which the force of attraction is in inverse proportion to the square of the distance. At the last post station before Otradnoye, he gave the driver a 3-ruble tip, and on arriving he ran breathlessly like a boy up the steps of his home. After the rapture of meeting, and after that odd feeling of unsatisfied expectation, the feeling that everything is just the same, so why did I hurry, Nicholas began to settle down in his old home world. His father and mother were much the same, only a little older. What was new in them was a certain uneasiness and occasional discord, which there used not to be, and which, as Nicholas soon found out, was due to the bad state of their affairs. Sonya was nearly 20. She had stopped growing prettier and promised nothing more than she was already, but that was enough. She exhaled happiness and love from the time Nicholas returned, and the faithful, unalterable love of this girl had a gladdening effect on him. Petya and Natasha surprised Nicholas most. Petya was a big, handsome boy of 13, merry, witty, and mischievous, with a voice that was already breaking. As for Natasha, for a long while Nicholas wondered and laughed whenever he looked at her. "You're not the same at all," he said. "How, am I uglier?" "On the contrary. But what dignity! A princess!" he whispered to her. "Yes, yes, yes," cried Natasha joyfully. She told him about her romance with Prince Andrew and of his visit to Otradnoye, and showed him his last letter. "Well, are you glad?" Natasha asked. "I'm so tranquil and happy now." "Very glad," answered Nicholas. "He's an excellent fellow. And are you very much in love? Well, how shall I put it? Replied Natasha. I was in love with Boris, with my teacher, and with Denisov, but this is quite different. I feel at peace and settled. I know that no better man than he exists, and I'm calm and contented now, not at all as before. Nicholas expressed his disapproval of the postponement of the marriage for a year, but Natasha attacked her brother with exasperation, proving to him that it could not be otherwise, and that it would be a bad thing to enter a family against the father's will, and that she herself wished it so. "You don't at all understand," she said. Nicholas was silent and agreed with her. Her brother often wondered as he looked at her. She did not seem at all like a girl in love and parted from her affianced husband. She was even-tempered and calm, and quite as cheerful as of old. This amazed Nicholas, and even made him regard Bolkonski's courtship skeptically. He could not believe that her fate was sealed, especially as he had not seen her with Prince Andrew. It always seemed to him that there was something not quite right about this intended marriage. Why this delay? Why no betrothal, he thought. Once, when he had touched on this topic with his mother, he discovered to his surprise and somewhat to his satisfaction that in the depth of her soul she too had doubts about this marriage. "You see, he writes," said she, showing her son a letter of Prince Andrew's, with that latent grudge a mother always has in regard to a daughter's future married happiness. "He writes that he won't come before December. What can be keeping him? Illness, probably. His health is very delicate. Now, don't tell Natasha. And don't attach importance to her being so bright. That's because she's living through the last days of her girlhood. But I know what she's like every time we receive a letter from him. However, God grant that everything turns out well." She always ended with these words. "He is an excellent man." Chapter 2. Nicholas Settles Accounts with Mityanka. After reaching home, Nicholas was at first serious and even dull. He was worried by the impending necessity of interfering in the stupid business matters for which his mother had called him home. To throw off this burden as quickly as possible, on the third day after his arrival, he went, angry and scowling, and without answering questions as to where he was going, to Mityanka's lodge, and demanded an account of everything. But what an account of everything might be, Nicholas knew even less than the frightened and bewildered Mityanka. The conversation and the examination of the accounts with Mityanka did not last long. The village elder, a peasant delegate, and the village clerk, who were waiting in the passage, heard with fear and delight first the young count's voice roaring and snapping and rising louder and louder, and then words of abuse, dreadful words, ejaculated one after the other. "Robber! Ungrateful wretch! I'll hack the dog to pieces. I'm not my father. Robbing us!" And so on. Then, with no less fear and delight, they saw how the young count, red in the face and with bloodshot eyes, dragged Mityanka out by the scruff of the neck and applied his foot and knee to him behind with great agility at convenient moments between the words, shouting, "Be off! Never let me see your face here again, you villain!" Mityanka flew headlong down the six steps and ran away into the shrubbery. This shrubbery was a well-known haven of refuge for culprits at Otradnoye. Mityanka himself, returning tipsy from the town, used to hide there, and many of the residents at Otradnoye, hiding from Mityanka, knew of its protective qualities. Mityanka's wife and sisters-in-law thrust their heads and frightened faces out of the door of a room where a bright samovar was boiling and where the steward's high bedstead stood with its patchwork quilt. The young count paid no heed to them, but, breathing hard, passed by with resolute strides and went into the house. The countess, who heard at once from the maids what had happened at the lodge, was calmed by the thought that now their affairs would certainly improve, but, on the other hand, felt anxious as to the effect this excitement might have on her son. She went several times to his door on tiptoe and listened, as he lighted one pipe after another. Next day, the old count called his son aside, and with an embarrassed smile said to him, "But, you know, my dear boy, it's a pity you got excited. Mityanka has told me all about it." "I knew," thought Nicholas, "that I should never understand anything in this crazy world." You were angry that he had not entered those 700 roubles, but they were carried forward, and you did not look at the other page. Papa, he's a blackguard and a thief. I know he is. And what I've done, I've done. But if you like, I won't speak to him again. No, my dear boy. The Count, too, felt embarrassed. He knew he had mismanaged his wife's property and was to blame toward his children, but he did not know how to remedy it. No, I beg you to attend to the business. I'm old, I... No, Papa, forgive me if I've caused you unpleasantness. I understand it all less than you do. Devil take all these peasants and money matters and carryings forward from page to page, he thought. I used to understand what a corner and the stakes at cards meant, but carrying forward to another page I don't understand at all, said he to himself. And after that he did not meddle in business affairs. But once the Countess called her son and informed him that she had a promissory note from Anna Mikhailovna for 2,000 roubles and asked him what he thought of doing with it. This, answered Nicholas. You say it rests with me. Well, I don't like Anna Mikhailovna, and I don't like Boris, but they were our friends and poor. Well, then, this. And he tore up the note, and by so doing caused the old Countess to weep tears of joy. After that, young Rostov took no further part in any business affairs, but devoted himself with passionate enthusiasm to what was to him a new pursuit, the chase, for which his father kept a large establishment. Chapter 3. Nicholas decides to go hunting. The weather was already growing wintry, and morning frosts congealed an earth saturated by autumn rains. The verdure had thickened, and its bright green stood out sharply against the brownish strips of winter rye trodden down by the cattle, and against the pale yellow stubble of the spring sowing, and the reddish strips of buckwheat. The wooded ravines and the copses, which at the end of August had still been green islands amid black fields and stubble, had become golden and bright red islands amid the green winter rye. The hares had already half changed their summer coats. The fox cubs were beginning to scatter, and the young wolves were bigger than dogs. It was the best time of the year for the chase. The hounds of that ardent young sportsman Rostov had not merely reached hard winter condition, but were so jaded that at a meeting of the huntsmen it was decided to give them a 3 days' rest, and then, on the 16th of September, to go on a distant expedition, starting from the oak grove where there was an undisturbed litter of wolf cubs. Note. Readers should bear in mind that the hounds engaged in hunting of the kind here described were keen-scented, but not very swift dogs. They had to find the game by scent and chase it in the desired direction. But the swift and strong borzois caught and killed the game. A borzoi has very poor scent, and only chases the game when he sees it. It must be pointed out to him, and even when following it, he sometimes loses sight of it. If the game shams dead, a borzoi is often balked and hesitates what to do, as in the case mentioned when the hare suddenly squatted and the borzoi did not seize it. All that day, the hounds remained at home. It was frosty, and the air was sharp. But toward evening the sky became overcast and it began to thaw. On the 15th, when young Rostov in his dressing gown looked out of the window, he saw it was an unsurpassable morning for hunting. It was as if the sky were melting and sinking to the earth without any wind. The only motion in the air was that of the dripping microscopic particles of drizzling mist. The bare twigs in the garden were hung with transparent drops which fell on the freshly fallen leaves. The earth in the kitchen garden looked wet and black, and glistened like poppy seed, and at a short distance merged into the dull, moist veil of mist. Nicholas went out into the wet and muddy porch. There was a smell of decaying leaves and of dog. Milka, a black-spotted, broad-haunched bitch with prominent black eyes, got up on seeing her master, stretched her hind legs, lay down like a hare, and then suddenly jumped up and licked him right on his nose and moustache. Another borzoi, a dog, catching sight of his master from the garden path, arched his back and, rushing headlong toward the porch with lifted tail, began rubbing himself against his legs.
"Ohoy!"
came at that moment that inimitable huntsman's call which unites the deepest bass with the shrillest tenor. and round the corner came Daniel, the head huntsman and head kennelman, a gray, wrinkled old man with hair cut straight over his forehead, Ukrainian fashion, a long bent whip in his hand, and that look of independence and scorn of everything that is only seen in huntsmen. He doffed his Circassian cap to his master and looked at him scornfully. This scorn was not offensive to his master. Nicholas knew that this Daniel, disdainful of everybody and who considered himself above them, was all the same his serf and huntsman. "Daniel," Nicholas said timidly, conscious at the sight of the weather, the hounds, and the huntsman, that he was being carried away by that irresistible passion for sport which makes a man forget all his previous resolutions, as a lover forgets in the presence of his mistress. "What orders, Your Excellency?" said the huntsman in his deep bass, deep as a protodeacon's and hoarse with hallooing, and two flashing black eyes gazed from under his brows at his master, who was silent. "Can you resist it?" those eyes seemed to be asking. "It's a good day, eh? For a hunt and a gallop, eh?" asked Nicholas, scratching Milka behind the ears. Daniel did not answer, but winked instead. "I sent to Varka at dawn to listen," his bass boomed out after a minute's pause. "He says she's moved them into the Otradnoye enclosure. They were howling there." This meant that the she-wolf, about whom they both knew, had moved with her cubs to the Otradnoye copse, a small place a mile and a half from the house. "We ought to go, don't you think so?" said Nicholas. "Come to me with Uvarka."
"As you please."
"Then put off feeding them."
"Yes, sir."
5 minutes later, Daniel and Uvarka were standing in Nicholas's big study. Though Daniel was not a big man, to see him in a room was like seeing a horse or a bear on the floor among the furniture and surroundings of human life. Daniel himself felt this, and as usual stood just inside the door, trying to speak softly and not move, for fear of breaking something in the master's apartment. And he hastened to say all that was necessary, so as to get from under that ceiling out into the open, under the sky, once more. Having finished his inquiries and extorted from Daniel an opinion that the hounds were fit, Daniel himself wished to go hunting, Nicholas ordered the horses to be saddled. But just as Daniel was about to go, Natasha came in with rapid steps, not having done up her hair or finished dressing, and with her old nurse's big shawl wrapped round her. Petya ran in at the same time. "You're going?" asked Natasha. "I knew you would. Sonya said you wouldn't go, but I knew that today is the sort of day when you couldn't help going." "Yes, we're going," replied Nicholas reluctantly, for today, as he intended to hunt seriously, he did not want to take Natasha and Petya. "We're going, but only wolf hunting. It would be dull for you."
"You know it's my greatest pleasure," said Natasha. "It's not fair. You're going by yourself, having the horses saddled, and said nothing to us about it."
"No barrier bars a Russian's path. We'll go," shouted Petya.
"But you can't. Mama said you mustn't," said Nicholas to Natasha.
"Yes, I'll go. I shall certainly go," said Natasha decisively. "Daniel, tell them to saddle for us. And Michael must come with my dogs," she added to the huntsman. It seemed to Daniel irksome and improper to be in a room at all, but to have anything to do with a young lady seemed to him impossible. He cast down his eyes and hurried out as if it were none of his business, careful as he went not to inflict any accidental injury on the young lady. Chapter 4. The Wolf Hunt Begins. The old count, who had always kept up an enormous hunting establishment, but had now handed it all completely over to his son's care, being in very good spirits on this 15th of September, prepared to go out with the others. In an hour's time, the whole hunting party was at the porch. Nicholas, with a stern and serious air which showed that now was no time for attending to trifles, went past Natasha and Petya, who were trying to tell him something. He had a look at all the details of the hunt, sent a pack of hounds and huntsmen on ahead to find the quarry, mounted his chestnut Donets, and, whistling to his own leash of borzois, set off across the threshing ground to a field leading to the Otradnoye wood. The old count's horse, a sorrel gelding called Vivyanka, was led by the groom in attendance on him, while the count himself was to drive in a small trap straight to a spot reserved for him. They were taking 54 hounds, with 6 hunt attendants and whippers in. Besides the family, there were 8 borzoi kennelmen and more than 40 borzois,
so that, with the borzois on the leash belonging to members of the family, there were about 130 dogs and 20 horsemen. Each dog knew its master and its call. Each man in the hunt knew his business, his place, and what he had to do. As soon as they had passed the fence, they all spread out evenly and quietly, without noise or talk, along the road and field leading to the Otradnoye covert. The horses stepped over the field as over a thick carpet, now and then splashing into puddles as they crossed a road. The misty sky still seemed to descend evenly and imperceptibly toward the earth. The air was still, warm, and silent. Occasionally the whistle of a huntsman, the snort of a horse, the crack of a whip, or the whine of a straggling hound could be heard. When they had gone a little less than a mile, five more riders with dogs appeared out of the mist, approaching the Rostovs. In front rode a fresh-looking, handsome old man with a large gray moustache. "Good morning, Uncle," said Nicholas when the old man drew near.
"That's it. Come on. I was sure of it," began Uncle.
He was a distant relative of the Rostovs, a man of small means, and their neighbor.
"I knew you wouldn't be able to resist it, and it's a good thing you're going. That's it. Come on."
This was Uncle's favorite expression.
"Take the covert at once, for my Girchik says the Ilagins are at Korniki with their hounds. That's it, come on. They'll take the cubs from under your very nose."
"That's where I'm going. Shall we join up our packs?" asked Nicholas. The hounds were joined into one pack, and Uncle and Nicholas rode on side by side. Natasha, muffled up in shawls which did not hide her eager face and shining eyes, galloped up to them. She was followed by Petya, who always kept close to her, by Michael, a huntsman, and by a groom appointed to look after her. Petya, who was laughing, whipped and pulled at his horse. Natasha sat easily and confidently on her black Arabchik and reined him in without effort with a firm hand. Uncle looked round disapprovingly at Petya and Natasha. He did not like to combine frivolity with the serious business of hunting.
"Good morning, Uncle. We're going, too," shouted Petya. "Good morning, good morning. But don't go over-riding the hounds," said Uncle sternly.
"Nicholas, what a fine dog Trunila is. He knew me," said Natasha, referring to her favorite hound. "In the first place, Trunila is not a dog, but a harrier," thought Nicholas, and looked sternly at his sister, trying to make her feel the distance that ought to separate them at that moment. Natasha understood it. "You mustn't think we'll be in anyone's way, Uncle," she said. "We'll go to our places and won't budge."
"A good thing, too, little countess," said Uncle. "Only mind you don't fall off your horse," he added, "because that's it, come on. You've nothing to hold on to."
The oasis of the Otradnoye covert came in sight a few hundred yards off. The huntsmen were already nearing it. Rostov, having finally settled with Uncle where they should set on the hounds, and having shown Natasha where she was to stand, a spot where nothing could possibly run out, went round above the ravine.
"Well, nephew, you're going for a big wolf," said Uncle. "Mind and don't let her slip."
"That's as may happen," answered Rostov.
"Karai! Here!" he shouted,
answering Uncle's remark by this call to his borzoi. Karai was a shaggy old dog with a hanging jowl, famous for having tackled a big wolf unaided. They all took up their places. The old count, knowing his son's ardor in the hunt, hurried so as not to be late, and the huntsmen had not yet reached their places when Count Ilya Rostov, cheerful, flushed, and with quivering cheeks, drove up with his black horses over the winter rye to the place reserved for him, where a wolf might come out. Having straightened his coat and fastened on his hunting knives and horn, he mounted his good, sleek, well-fed, and comfortable horse Bifyanka, which was turning gray like himself. His horses and trap were sent home. Count Ilya Rostov, though not at heart a keen sportsman, knew the rules of the hunt well, and rode to the bushy edge of the road where he was to stand, arranged his reins, settled himself in the saddle, and, feeling that he was ready, looked about him with a smile. Beside him was Simon Chikmar, his personal attendant, an old horseman now somewhat stiff in the saddle. Chikmar held in leash three formidable wolfhounds, who had, however, grown fat like their master and his horse. Two wise old dogs lay down unleashed. Some 100 paces farther along the edge of the wood stood Mitka, the count's other groom, a daring horseman and keen rider to hounds. Before the hunt, by old custom, the Count had drunk a silver cupful of mulled brandy, taken a snack, and washed it down with half a bottle of his favorite Bordeaux. He was somewhat flushed with the wine and the drive. His eyes were rather moist and glittered more than usual, and as he sat in his saddle, wrapped up in his fur coat, he looked like a child taken out for an outing. The thin, hollow-cheeked Chekmar, having got everything ready, kept glancing at his master, with whom he had lived on the best of terms for 30 years, and, understanding the mood he was in, expected a pleasant chat. A third person rode up circumspectly through the wood. It was plain that he had had a lesson, and stopped behind the Count. This person was a gray-bearded old man in a woman's cloak with a tall peaked cap on his head. He was the buffoon who went by a woman's name, Nastasia Ivanovna. Note, the practice of keeping a buffoon in country houses lasted till after the abolition of serfdom. "Well, Nastasia Ivanovna," whispered the Count, winking at him, "if you scare away the beast, Daniel will give it to you."
"I know a thing or two myself," said Nastasia Ivanovna.
"Hush," whispered the Count, and turned to Simon. "Have you seen the young countess?" he asked. "Where is she?"
"With young Count Peter, by the Zharov rank grass," answered Simon, smiling. "Though she's a lady, she's very fond of hunting."
"And you're surprised at the way she rides, Simon, eh?" said the Count. "She's as good as many a man."
"Of course, it's marvelous. So bold, so easy."
"And Nicholas, where is he? By the Lyadov upland, isn't he?"
"Yes, sir. He knows where to stand. He understands the matter so well that Daniel and I are often quite astounded," said Simon, well knowing what would please his master. "Rides well, eh?"
"And how well he looks on his horse, eh?"
"What a perfect picture.
How he chased a fox out of the rank grass by the Zavarzinsk thicket the other day. Leaped a fearful place. What a sight when they rushed from the covert. The horse worth 1,000 rubles and the rider beyond all price. Yes, one would have to search far to find another as smart."
"To search far," repeated the Count, evidently sorry Simon had not said more. "To search far," he said, turning back the skirt of his coat to get at his snuff-box.
"The other day, when he came out from Mass in full uniform, Michael Sidorich..."
Simon did not finish, for on the still air he had distinctly caught the music of the hunt, with only 2 or 3 hounds giving tongue. He bent down his head and listened, shaking a warning finger at his master.
"They're on the scent of the cubs," he whispered. "Straight to the Lyadov uplands."
The Count, forgetting to smooth out the smile on his face, looked into the distance straight before him, down the narrow open space, holding the snuff-box in his hand, but not taking any. After the cry of the hounds came the deep tones of the wolf call from Daniel's hunting horn. The pack joined the first 3 hounds, and they could be heard in full cry, with that peculiar lift in the note that indicates that they're after a wolf. The whippers-in no longer set on the hounds, but changed to the cry of "Ooloo!" And above the others rose Daniel's voice, now a deep bass, now piercingly shrill. His voice seemed to fill the whole wood and carried far beyond, out into the open field. After listening a few moments in silence, the old Count and his attendant convinced themselves that the hounds had separated into 2 packs. The sound of the larger pack, eagerly giving tongue, began to die away in the distance. The other pack rushed by the wood past the Count, and it was with this that Daniel's voice was heard calling "Ooloo!" The sounds of both packs mingled and broke apart again, but both were becoming more distant. Simon sighed and stooped to straighten the leash a young borzoi had entangled. The Count, too, sighed, and, noticing the snuff-box in his hand, opened it and took a pinch.
"Back!"
cried Simon to a borzoi that was pushing forward out of the wood. The Count started and dropped the snuff-box. Nastasya Ivanovna dismounted to pick it up. The Count and Simon were looking at him. Then, unexpectedly, as often happens, the sound of the hunt suddenly approached, as if the hounds in full cry and Daniel ululuing were just in front of them. The Count turned and saw on his right Mitka staring at him with eyes starting out of his head, raising his cap and pointing before him to the other side.
"Look out!" he shouted, in a voice plainly showing that he had long fretted to utter that word,
and letting the borzoi slip, he galloped toward the Count. The Count and Simon galloped out of the wood and saw on their left a wolf, which, softly swaying from side to side, was coming at a quiet lope farther to the left, to the very place where they were standing. The angry borzois whined, and getting free of the leash, rushed past the horse's feet at the wolf. The wolf paused, turned its heavy forehead toward the dogs awkwardly, like a man suffering from the quinsy, and, still slightly swaying from side to side, gave a couple of leaps, and with a swish of its tail disappeared into the skirt of the wood. At the same instant, with a cry like a wail, first one hound, then another sprang helter-skelter from the wood opposite, and the whole pack rushed across the field toward the very spot where the wolf had disappeared. The hazel bushes parted behind the hounds, and Daniel's chestnut horse appeared, dark with sweat. On its long back sat Daniel, hunched forward, capless, his disheveled gray hair hanging over his flushed, perspiring face.
"Ooh-loo-loo-loo-loo!
He cried. When he caught sight of the Count, his eyes flashed lightning.
"Blast you!"
he shouted, holding up his whip threateningly at the Count.
"You've let the wolf go! What a sportsman!"
And as if scorning to say more to the frightened and shamefaced Count, he lashed the heaving flanks of his sweating chestnut gelding with all the anger the Count had aroused, and flew off after the hounds. The Count, like a punished schoolboy, looked round, trying by a smile to win Simon's sympathy for his plight. But Simon was no longer there. He was galloping round by the bushes while the field was coming up on both sides, all trying to head the wolf. But it vanished into the wood before they could do so. Chapter 5. The Wolf is Taken. Nicholas Rostov, meanwhile, remained at his post waiting for the wolf. By the way the hunt approached and receded, by the cries of the dogs whose notes were familiar to him, by the way the voices of the huntsmen approached, receded, and rose, he realized what was happening at the copse. He knew that young and old wolves were there, that the hounds had separated into two packs, that somewhere a wolf was being chased, and that something had gone wrong. He expected the wolf to come his way any moment. He made thousands of different conjectures as to where and from what side the beast would come and how he would set upon it. Hope alternated with despair. Several times he addressed a prayer to God that the wolf should come his way. He prayed with that passionate and shamefaced feeling with which men pray at moments of great excitement arising from trivial causes. "What would it be to thee to do this for me?" he said to God. "I know thou art great, and that it is a sin to ask this of thee, but for God's sake do let the old wolf come my way, and let Karai spring at it, in sight of Uncle, who's watching from over there, and seize it by the throat in a death grip." A thousand times during that half hour, Rostov cast eager and restless glances over the edge of the wood, with the two scraggy oaks rising above the aspen undergrowth, and the gully with its water-worn side, and Uncle's cap just visible above the bush on his right. "No, I shan't have such luck," thought Rostov. "Yet what wouldn't it be worth? It is not to be. Everywhere, at cards and in war, I'm always unlucky." Memories of Austerlitz and of Dolokhov flashed rapidly and clearly through his mind. "Only once in my life to get an old wolf. I want only that," thought he, straining eyes and ears, and looking to the left and then to the right, and listening to the slightest variation of note in the cries of the dogs. Again he looked to the right, and saw something running toward him across the deserted field. "No, it can't be," thought Rostov, taking a deep breath, as a man does at the coming of something long hoped for. The height of happiness was reached, and so simply, without warning or noise or display, that Rostov could not believe his eyes, and remained in doubt for over a second. The wolf ran forward and jumped heavily over a gully that lay in her path. She was an old animal, with a gray back and big reddish belly. She ran without hurry, evidently feeling sure that no one saw her. Rostov, holding his breath, looked round at the borzois. They stood or lay, not seeing the wolf or understanding the situation. Old Karai had turned his head and was angrily searching for fleas, baring his yellow teeth and snapping at his hind legs.
"Ooh-loo-loo-loo,"
whispered Rostov, pouting his lips. The borzois jumped up, jerking the rings of the leashes and pricking their ears. Karai finished scratching his hindquarters, and cocking his ears, got up with quivering tail, from which tufts of matted hair hung down. "Shall I loose them or not?" Nicholas asked himself, as the wolf approached him, coming from the copse.
Suddenly the wolf's whole physiognomy changed. She shuddered, seeing what she had probably never seen before, human eyes fixed upon her, and turning her head a little toward Rostov, she paused. Back or forward? No matter, forward, the wolf seemed to say to herself. And she moved forward without again looking round, and with a quiet, long, easy, yet resolute lope.
Ululu!
Cried Nicholas in a voice not his own, and of its own accord his good horse darted headlong downhill, leaping over gullies to head off the wolf, and the borzois passed it, running faster still. Nicholas did not hear his own cry, nor feel that he was galloping, nor see the borzois, nor the ground over which he went. He saw only the wolf, who, increasing her speed, bounded on in the same direction along the hollow. The first to come into view was Milka, with her black markings and powerful quarters, gaining upon the wolf. Nearer and nearer. Now she was ahead of it. But the wolf turned its head to face her, and instead of putting on speed as she usually did, Milka suddenly raised her tail and stiffened her forelegs.
Ululululu!
Shouted Nicholas. The reddish Lyubim rushed forward from behind Milka, sprang impetuously at the wolf, and seized it by its hind quarters, but immediately jumped aside in terror. The wolf crouched, gnashed her teeth, and again rose and bounded forward, followed at the distance of a couple of feet by all the borzois, who did not get any closer to her.
She'll get away. No, it's impossible, thought Nicholas, still shouting with a hoarse voice.
Karai! Ululu!
He shouted, looking round for the old borzoi, who was now his only hope. Karai, with all the strength age had left him, stretched himself to the utmost, and, watching the wolf, galloped heavily aside to intercept it. But the quickness of the wolf's lope and the borzoi's slower pace made it plain that Karai had miscalculated. Nicholas could already see not far in front of him the wood where the wolf would certainly escape should she reach it. But coming toward him, he saw hounds and a huntsman galloping almost straight at the wolf. There was still hope. A long, yellowish young borzoi, one Nicholas did not know from another leash, rushed impetuously at the wolf from in front and almost knocked her over. But the wolf jumped up more quickly than anyone could have expected, and, gnashing her teeth, flew at the yellowish borzoi, which, with a piercing yelp, fell with its head on the ground, bleeding from a gash in its side.
"Karai! Old fellow!"
wailed Nicholas. Thanks to the delay caused by this crossing of the wolf's path, the old dog, with its felted hair hanging from its thigh, was within 5 paces of it. As if aware of her danger, the wolf turned her eyes on Karai, tucked her tail yet further between her legs, and increased her speed. But here Nicholas only saw that something happened to Karai. The borzoi was suddenly on the wolf, and they rolled together down into a gully just in front of them. That instant, when Nicholas saw the wolf struggling in the gully with the dogs, while from under them could be seen her gray hair and outstretched hind leg and her frightened, choking head with her ears laid back, Karai was pinning her by the throat, was the happiest moment of his life. With his hand on his saddle-bow, he was ready to dismount and stab the wolf, when she suddenly thrust her head up from among that mass of dogs, and then her forepaws were on the edge of the gully. She clicked her teeth, Karai no longer had her by the throat, leaped with a movement of hind legs out of the gully, and having disengaged herself from the dogs, with tail tucked in again, went forward. Karai, his hair bristling and probably bruised or wounded, climbed with difficulty out of the gully.
"Oh, my God, why?" Nicholas cried in despair.
Uncle's huntsman was galloping from the other side across the wolf's path, and his borzois once more stopped the animal's advance. She was again hemmed in. Nicholas and his attendant, with Uncle and his huntsman, were all riding round the wolf, crying, "Ululu," shouting and preparing to dismount each moment that the wolf crouched back, and starting forward again every time she shook herself and moved toward the wood where she would be safe. Already, at the beginning of this chase, Daniel, hearing the ululuing, had rushed out from the wood. He saw Karai seize the wolf and checked his horse, supposing the affair to be over. But when he saw that the horseman did not dismount and that the wolf shook herself and ran for safety, Daniel set his chestnut galloping, not at the wolf, but straight toward the wood, just as Karai had run to cut the animal off. As a result of this, he galloped up to the wolf just when she had been stopped a second time by Uncle's borzois. Daniel galloped up silently, holding a naked dagger in his left hand and thrashing the laboring sides of his chestnut horse with his whip as if it were a flail. Nicholas neither saw nor heard Daniel until the chestnut, breathing heavily, panted past him,
and he heard the fall of a body and saw Daniel lying on the wolf's back among the dogs, trying to seize her by the ears. It was evident to the dogs, the hunters, and to the wolf herself that all was now over. The terrified wolf pressed back her ears and tried to rise, but the borzois stuck to her. Daniel rose a little, took a step, and with his whole weight, as if lying down to rest, fell on the wolf, seizing her by the ears. Nicholas was about to stab her, but Daniel whispered, "Don't! We'll gag her!" and, changing his position, set his foot on the wolf's neck. A stick was thrust between her jaws, and she was fastened with a leash, as if bridled. Her legs were bound together, and Daniel rolled her over once or twice from side to side. With happy, exhausted faces, they laid the old wolf alive on a shying and snorting horse, and, accompanied by the dogs yelping at her, took her to the place where they were all to meet. The hounds had killed two of the cubs, and the borzois three. The huntsmen assembled with their booty and their stories, and all came to look at the wolf, which, with her broad-browed head hanging down and the bitten stick between her jaws, gazed with great glassy eyes at this crowd of dogs and men surrounding her. When she was touched, she jerked her bound legs and looked wildly yet simply at everybody. Old Count Rostov also rode up and touched the wolf. "Oh, what a formidable one," said he. "A formidable one, eh?" he asked Daniel, who was standing near. "Yes, Your Excellency," answered Daniel, quickly doffing his cap. The Count remembered the wolf he had let slip and his encounter with Daniel. "Ah, but you're a crusty fellow, friend," said the Count. For sole reply, Daniel gave him a shy, childlike, meek, and amiable smile. Chapter 6. The Fox Hunt and the Huntsman's Quarrel. Ilagin's Courtesy. Chasing a Hare. Rugai's Triumph. The old Count went home, and Natasha and Petya promised to return very soon. But as it was still early, the hunt went farther. At midday, they put the hounds into a ravine thickly overgrown with young trees. Nicholas, standing in a fallow field, could see all his whips. Facing him lay a field of winter rye, and there his own huntsman stood alone in a hollow behind a hazel bush. The hounds had scarcely been loosed before Nicholas heard one he knew, Voltorn, giving tongue at intervals. Other hounds joined in, now pausing and now again giving tongue. A moment later he heard a cry from the wooded ravine that a fox had been found, and the whole pack, joining together, rushed along the ravine toward the rye field and away from Nicholas. He saw the whips in their red caps galloping along the edge of the ravine. He even saw the hounds, and was expecting a fox to show itself at any moment on the rye field opposite. The huntsman, standing in the hollow, moved and loosed his borzois, and Nicholas saw a queer, short-legged red fox with a fine brush going hard across the field. The borzois bore down on it. Now they drew close to the fox, which began to dodge between the field in sharper and sharper curves, trailing its brush, when suddenly a strange white borzoi dashed in, followed by a black one, and everything was in confusion. The borzois formed a star-shaped figure, scarcely swaying their bodies, and with tails turned away from the center of the group. Two huntsmen galloped up to the dogs, one in a red cap, the other, a stranger, in a green coat. "What's this?" thought Nicholas. "Where's that huntsman from? He's not Uncle's man." The huntsman got the fox, but stayed there a long time without strapping it to the saddle. Their horses, bridled and with high saddles, stood near them, and there, too, the dogs were lying. The huntsmen waved their arms and did something to the fox. Then from that spot came the sound of a horn, with the signal agreed on in case of a fight. "That's Ilagin's huntsman having a row with our Ivan," said Nicholas's groom. Nicholas sent the man to call Natasha and Petya to him, and rode at a foot pace to the place where the whips were getting the hounds together. Several of the field galloped to the spot where the fight was going on. Nicholas dismounted, and with Natasha and Petya, who had ridden up, stopped near the hounds, waiting to see how the matter would end. Out of the bushes came the huntsman who had been fighting and rode toward his young master with the fox tied to his crupper. While still at a distance, he took off his cap and tried to speak respectfully, but he was pale and breathless, and his face was angry. One of his eyes was black, but he probably was not even aware of it. "What has happened?" asked Nicholas. A likely thing. Killing a fox our dogs had hunted. And it was my gray bitch that caught it. Go to law, indeed. He snatches at the fox. I gave him one with the fox. Here it is on my saddle. You want a taste of this?
Said the huntsman, pointing to his dagger, and probably imagining himself still speaking to his foe. Nicholas, not stopping to talk to the man, asked his sister and Petya to wait for him, and rode to the spot where the enemy's, Ilagin's, hunting party was. The victorious huntsman rode off to join the field, and there, surrounded by inquiring sympathizers, recounted his exploits. The facts were that Ilagin, with whom the Rostovs had a quarrel and were at law, hunted over places that belonged by custom to the Rostovs, and had now, as if purposely, sent his men to the very woods the Rostovs were hunting, and let his man snatch a fox their dogs had chased. Nicholas, though he had never seen Ilagin, with his usual absence of moderation in judgment, hated him cordially from reports of his arbitrariness and violence, and regarded him as his bitterest foe. He rode in angry agitation toward him, firmly grasping his whip, and fully prepared to take the most resolute and desperate steps to punish his enemy. Hardly had he passed an angle of the wood before a stout gentleman in a beaver cap came riding toward him on a handsome raven-black horse, accompanied by two hunt servants. Instead of an enemy, Nicholas found in Ilagin a stately and courteous gentleman who was particularly anxious to make the young count's acquaintance. Having ridden up to Nicholas, Ilagin raised his beaver cap and said he much regretted what had occurred and would have the man punished who had allowed himself to seize a fox hunted by someone else's borzois. He hoped to become better acquainted with the count and invited him to draw his covert. Natasha, afraid that her brother would do something dreadful, had followed him in some excitement. Seeing the enemies exchanging friendly greetings, she rode up to them. Ilagin lifted his beaver cap still higher to Natasha and said with a pleasant smile that the young countess resembled Diana in her passion for the chase as well as in her beauty, of which he had heard much. To expiate his huntsman's offense, Ilagin pressed the Rostovs to come to an upland of his about a mile away, which he usually kept for himself, and which he said swarmed with hares. Nicholas agreed, and the hunt, now doubled, moved on. The way to Ilagin's upland was across the fields. The hunt servants fell into line. The masters rode together. Uncle, Rostov, and Ilagin kept stealthily glancing at one another's dogs, trying not to be observed by their companions, and searching uneasily for rivals of their own borzois. Rostov was particularly struck by the beauty of a small, purebred, red-spotted bitch on Ilagin's leash. Slender, but with muscles like steel, a delicate muzzle, and prominent black eyes. He had heard of the swiftness of Ilagin's borzois, and in that beautiful bitch saw a rival to his own Milka. In the middle of a sober conversation begun by Ilagin about the year's harvest, Nicholas pointed to the red-spotted bitch. "A fine little bitch, that," said he in a careless tone. "Is she swift?" "That one? Yeah, she's a good dog. Gets what she's after," answered Ilagin indifferently of the red-spotted bitch Erza, for which a year before he had given a neighbor three families of house serfs. "So in your parts, too, the harvest is nothing to boast of, Count," he went on, continuing the conversation they had begun. And considering it polite to return the young count's compliment, Ilagin looked at his borzois and picked out Milka, who attracted his attention by her breadth. "That black-spotted one of yours is fine. Well-shaped," said he. "Yeah, she's fast enough," replied Nicholas, and thought, "If only a full-grown hare would cross the field now, I'd show you what sort of borzoi she is." And turning to his groom, he said he would give a ruble to anyone who found a hare. "I don't understand," continued Ilagin, "how some sportsmen can be so jealous about game and dogs. For myself, I can tell you, Count, I enjoy riding in company such as this. What could be better?" He again raised his cap to Natasha. "But as for counting skins and what one takes, I don't care about that." "Oh, of course not. Or being upset because someone else's borzoi and not mine catches something. All I care about is to enjoy seeing the chase. Is it not so, Count? For I consider that..." "Atu!" came the long-drawn cry of one of the borzoi whippers-in who had halted. He stood on a knoll in the stubble, holding his whip aloft, and again repeated his long-drawn cry,
Atu!
This call and the uplifted whip meant that he saw a sitting hare. Ah, he's found one, I think, said Ilagin carelessly. Well, let us course it, Count. Yes, we must ride up. Shall we both course it? Answered Nicholas. Seeing in Erza and in Uncle's Red Rugai two rivals he had never yet had a chance of pitting against his own borzois. And suppose they outdo my Milka at once, he thought, as he rode with Uncle and Ilagin toward the hare. A full-grown one? Asked Ilagin, as he approached the whip who had sighted the hare, and not without agitation he looked round and whistled to Erza. And you, Michael Nikanorovich? He said, addressing Uncle. The latter was riding with a sullen expression on his face.
How can I join in? Why, you've given a village for each of your borzois. That's it, come on. Yours are worth thousands. Try yours against one another, you two, and I'll look on. Rugai! Hey, hey! He shouted. Rugayushka! He added, involuntarily by this diminutive expressing his affection and the hopes he placed on this red borzoi. Natasha saw and felt the agitation the two elderly men and her brother were trying to conceal, and was herself excited by it. The huntsman stood halfway up the knoll, holding up his whip, and the gentlefolk rode up to him at a footpace. The hounds that were far off on the horizon turned away from the hare, and the whips, but not the gentlefolk, also moved away. All were moving slowly and sedately. "How's it pointing?" asked Nicholas, riding 100 paces toward the whip who had sighted the hare. But before the whip could reply, the hare, scenting the frost coming next morning, was unable to rest and leaped up. The pack on leash rushed downhill in full cry after the hare, and from all sides the borzois that were not on leash darted after the hounds and the hare. All the hunt, who had been moving slowly, shouted, "Stop!" calling in the hounds, while the borzoi whips, with a cry of "Atu!" galloped across the field, setting the borzois on the hare. The tranquil Ilagin, Nicholas, Natasha, and Uncle flew, reckless of where and how they went, seeing only the borzois and the hare, and fearing only to lose sight even for an instant of the chase. The hare they had started was a strong and swift one. When he jumped up, he did not run at once, but pricked his ears, listening to the shouting and trampling that resounded from all sides at once. He took 12 bounds, not very quickly, letting the borzois gain on him, and finally, having chosen his direction and realized his danger, laid back his ears and rushed off headlong.